Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, Cesar Romero.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Ivy Podcast. And today I'm excited to bring on our next guest. If you are looking for your next step in your career, if you feel stuck, if you feel like you want to take more responsibility for where you're going with your career, then this episode is especially for you. And we live in a time of constant change. And the ability to take control of your career is going to become even more important than ever. And my guest today, Ed Everts, he is the founder and president of Excelius Leadership Development, a Boston-based coaching organization. And he works with leaders to increase their self-awareness so they can manage themselves and thrive in their career. He's also the author of Raise Your Visibility and Value, Uncover the Lost Art of Connecting on the Job. That's his first book. And he's also the host of Be Brave at Work, a weekly podcast in which leaders share stories about their journey and in their careers and the impact that the choices have. And today we're going to be focusing on his latest book, Drive Your Career, and talking about how you can take more control of your career. Ed, it's a pleasure to have you on the show, and I'm really excited for our conversation today.
Thank you, Cesar. I'm thrilled to be here. And likewise, I look forward to chatting with you about these topics.
Excellent. And to kick us off, Ed, how did you get into leadership coaching? You know, what was that moment for you that you decided this is what I'm going to build a career on?
Well, it's interesting you should phrase it that way, because it was a moment that occurred in my career. I had been employed in corporate America for about 25 years. I was laid off at my last employer due to just changes in the profile and the way that the organization was interacting in the marketplace. I had never expected to start my own practice. I had never expected to be self-employed, but there I was in transition. And I just decided that this was the right time in my life and the right time in my career to explore doing something different. I could have gone into the job market and found another opportunity and continued to do what I had been doing, but I decided to reinvent myself in certain ways and take all the years of experience that I had and apply it in a different way, right? To help people versus just help myself. So in 2008, I began this journey of starting my own leadership development practice that I continue to operate today.
That's excellent. And I want to dive deeper a little bit into that, because I know a lot of people, friends and colleagues that might be at that fork on the road for them, whether they make a career shift, take another job, or start their own business. And a lot of the feedback that I hear is that uncertainty and that fear of, I don't know if this is going to work out. And I wanted to ask you, what was that process for you like? To, was there any fear? If there was, how do you overcome that fear of, hey, this might not work out, but I think it might be the right decision?
Well, upon reflection, it was, but at the time, I wasn't sure, right? So I don't know that you can overcome fear. I think fear may be just a very natural part of the process that you experience. Mm-hmm. In my case, it wasn't a choice. I had been laid off. And so, you know, there I was with the hand I was dealt, and I had to figure out what I needed to do next. I think it's harder for somebody who is employed, mm-hmm. who might be thinking, hey, I'd love to do this on my own, but there may be a gap between where I am and where I want to be. And can I navigate that gap financially and professionally, successfully, right? So that can create fear. But for me, you know, I had the benefit of severance. I had the benefit of unemployment. So that helped take care of kind of the financial piece of the transition. Mm-hmm. And I just began working on building my skill set and building my awareness in the marketplace to ensure that I could be successful. And I spent the summer of 2008 networking with anybody who would talk to me about coaching and my own business and things of that nature. And by the end of the summer of 2008, I can still remember talking with my wife and saying, look, I'm going to do this. And I can't think of any reason why this will not be successful. It might take a little time. So I need for us to figure out how to navigate this, but I know this will work and I'm all in and I want to make it work. So, you know, I think fear is a natural piece of that. It might keep you motivated, for example, but, you know, the goal is if you really believe this is something that you can do, there's no reason why you can't be successful at it. It's a very big marketplace. There are lots of coaches out there, mm-hmm. and there are lots of leaders who need help, and those leaders continue to evolve and new leaders come in and now they need help and so forth and so on. So, you know, I think it's been a great industry to work in and to, you know, try to have a successful practice in.
I agree with you 100%. It's especially in this day and age, being able to help other people become the leaders that they can be is extremely important. I feel like we're almost in a leadership crisis. We need more leaders that take on that journey, right? And one of the things that you mentioned is, and this is a big topic in your book, the whole concept of self-awareness, right? And what was that process like for you to develop that self-awareness of, you know, this is my skill set, this is what I want to be doing, these are my goals, and how to align that with your next step in your career? And maybe give us some tips or tactics that our audience can use to, maybe they don't have their self-awareness fully developed yet. You know, some of the tips and tools that they could use to embark on this journey.
I think that's a great first question, Cesar. And, you know, when I think about self-awareness, I believe through my journey in life that self-awareness is the key to understanding yourself, how others experience you in the workplace, which is equally as important, and how you can self-manage yourself to be more effective. That's part of the reason I wrote the book, Drive Your Career, was to share some stories to help people look at and think about how they can build their self-awareness. You know, people with very high self-awareness know what they're good at. They know what they're not good at, and that's okay. We're not designed all to be perfect and be perfect at everything. So there are going to be some things that I'm not good at or I don't enjoy doing. And I have to build teams of people who can fill those gaps, right? So we have a well-rounded group of people. Mm-hmm. And I want to maximize the strengths that I have. This is true for everyone. And I think part of it is a life journey. So I think somebody who is in their early 20s is probably not caring a lot about self-awareness right. and how people experience them in the workplace, where as somebody in their, you know, mid-50s, you know, might be thinking about it a lot and are thinking about the, you know, final kind of two chapters in their career and wanting to leave a legacy and ensure people think back on them as somebody that they love to work with and were motivated by and inspired by. So I think self-awareness kind of grows as time. That said, leadership roles change very quickly today. Mm-hmm. People are in roles that probably used to take 10 or 15 years to get to, and now they're moving into them in 3 or 4 years. You know, constantly do I hear clients getting elevated and promoted even while we're working together. And while that's great for them professionally and financially, they still don't have the skill set and experiences to rationalize those roles. So they're now a head of sales, or they're the head of marketing, or they're the head of real estate, but they don't have the experiences in totality. They certainly have a lot of experience, but not in totality, the experience to be successful. And so that's why folks need to think about who they are, what their areas of strengths are, what their areas of opportunity are, and work on those areas of opportunity so they can be more effective. You mentioned a couple of ideas, and I'll just share with you one of the key ideas that I work with clients on is doing a 360. And a 360 mm-hmm. is a feedback assessment where you go to bosses, peers, and subordinates and ask them, what is it like to work with me in the workplace? Mm-hmm. And the information that's shared is confidential and anonymous. It produces an aggregation of all that data, so you never know who said what. I know people like mm-hmm. to figure out who said what, but you know, it doesn't tell you who said what, but it just tells you what people experience when they work with you. And almost every report that I've ever shared with a client feels very honest. Mm-hmm. The client shakes their head because they know that the stuff that people are telling them are accurate. But the more important piece is that they're building their self-awareness on how people are experiencing them, so we can put together steps and activities they can work on in order to make good progress.
So with the 360 feedback, I think it's, yeah, super, super important. But in the practical terms, like, let's say you want to bring the conversation, and whether, you know, it's a teammate or your boss, about, hey, I have this idea, I think we could both benefit from doing a 360 assessment. How do you start that conversation? And what if your boss is like, no, we don't need to do that. What were you recommending in that scenario?
Well, there are two challenges that somebody might face in doing a 360. One is financial. So they're, I'm not suggesting they're wildly expensive, but it does cost money to do it. And the other might be cultural. That is just not how we do things here, right? Mm-hmm. So I've had people say, I've just been told that's just not something we want to do here. We don't want to go off and ask other people what they experience and they work with you. So, I always encourage people, and most clients who come to me already have talked about it with their boss. It's already been approved. And so they've not met those type of obstacles. But, if you do believe that there are opportunities to build your self-awareness, and so for new leaders who have been in a role for about a year, that's a great time to do a 360. So you can find out how people are experiencing you, which provides you time to do something about it, because it's still early in your career. For people who have been in their role a while, it's a good time to do a 360, because you can fall into habits and behaviors that may not be helpful, and mm-hmm. people need to provide you that feedback so you can make those modifications. Step number one is to go to your boss and say, look, I'm new in my role. I've been here about a year, or, I've now been in this role for a few years. I think I can be more effective. I'd like to collect feedback from folks on how they're experiencing me, so I can be more aware of the goods and the areas of opportunity I need to work on. Is this something that the organization can support me on? I would tell you, based on my experience, 9 times out of 10, the answer would be yes, let's do it. Mm-hmm. Again, you might be in an organization where either financially it can't be afforded, or culturally it's just not done. And there are other things that you can do, just to ramble on for a minute. And if you find that you can't do a 360, you can always do a narrative. So a narrative is where you meet with people and talk with them about how they experience you. So it's a little bit lower cost on your part, but it still creates some of the opportunity. The difference is that it's not anonymous. And so it may be harder for people to be directly honest with you about the things they think you could do differently to be more effective. But you're certainly going to have more data than you would have had if you did nothing.
Right. Yeah. I can see how the narrative approach can be, I guess you guess more one-on-one time with a colleague or your boss. But there's a barrier of, so people don't like to be straightforward for whatever reason. Yeah, it's hard. Go ahead. Finish that thought. And then
I was going to say it's hard. And, in the book, I talk about the $1 million question, which is something all of us should be asking our boss, peer, subordinates, at least once a year. You don't have to do it often, but you want to do it on a regular basis. And this can help Caesar in breaking through those barriers that people might have. And the $1 million question is, what's one or two things I can do differently to be more effective? You're not looking for 30 or 40 things. You just want one or two. It's what am I going to do differently, not better or worse, because that makes people feel like they're judging you. But difference is just different than how I'm doing it. It's not better. It's not worse. It's just different. And then who wouldn't want to help somebody be more effective? So if you start asking that question and you listen, and then you start modifying how you're doing things, people will believe that they're helping. And if they believe that they can help you, their likelihood for being honest is greater.
Absolutely. And I read that question in the book, and I thought about it for a minute. And it's such a powerful question, right? Like, what is one or two things I could be doing more effectively? And it's powerful because you're asking your boss or your teammate, right, or a colleague, how can we make this better, right? How can we make this work relationship better? And it's a great data point to incorporate into your feedback loop and into your self-awareness, right? And another thing that stood out to me was you make a point in your book on the difference between self-knowledge and self-awareness. And I wanted to ask you about that, like, what what's the difference, right, between having self-knowledge and turning that into self-awareness?
Yeah, and if I can just go back for a second, Caesar, I don't mean to pick on you, but it's just very specific on how you ask the question. So It's what's one or two things can I do differently? If you say more effective or better or worse, people might feel that you're judging and are uncomfortable sharing it. So the question itself has to be asked very specifically to increase the likelihood that somebody's going to share that data with you. So I just encourage our listeners to use that language. What do you think? It's one or two things I could do differently, not better or worse, effective, less effective, et cetera. So
that's right. Don't qualify it. Just differently. Right. Yeah, it's not important.
Yeah. It's just difference. Difference is a much more neutral way of asking the question, and you'll still get great feedback, but it just helps create a back and forth that's going to be a lot more effective. So, you know, self-awareness and self-knowledge are two different things. To me, self-awareness is all about how others experience you in the workplace, the good and the bad. Nobody's perfect. And there are things every leader, and when I say every leader, I do mean every leader, could be doing a little bit differently to be more effective. Even the greatest leaders in the world could be still doing one or two things a little bit differently to be more effective. But you have to be aware of it, right? Mm-hmm. You can't do something about it unless you're aware of it. And I'm sure many of our listeners have worked with people who are hard to work for. And I would argue that many of them probably have low self-awareness. They just don't realize that that's the impact that they're having on people. No one has asked them to share that. No one has done a 360, so they don't have any reason to know, right? So they're just plugging along because their self-awareness is low. So self-awareness needs to be high. Self-knowledge is a little bit different because that's kind of how we perceive ourselves operating in the world. And you know, I would tell you that while nobody knows you as well as you do, which is one of the chapters in the book we talk about, because you need to take time to self-reflect and recognize who you are and how you operate, self-knowledge can be a little skewed, right? We might think we're a little bit better at something than we really are. And you know, this is what we call blind spots. Mm-hmm. And so this is where I think I'm great. And then I go off and do a 360 and everyone tells me I'm terrible. You know, I thought I was great. So my self-awareness is now higher because people have shared with me how they experienced me, but my self-knowledge was low, right? Because in my mind, I thought I was great. So self-knowledge can be a little bit skewed. And while I think self-knowledge is very important, so when I work with clients, I look to explore their self-knowledge. My real goal is to work on self-awareness so they know exactly how others experience them, because that's how they need to now think about operating a little bit differently in order to be more effective.
So self-awareness is all about how others experience you.
Yes.
I love that. And it's the first time I hear that definition of self-awareness, and I love it, because you're right. You can have an idea in your head on maybe you think you're a good writer, right? But it's not until you put your writing out into the world and you get feedback from people that you realize, oh, wait a minute, I actually need to work on this. I'm not as good as I thought I was.
Right. And I got this idea of experience from a colleague of mine at Iron Mountain, who one day said to me, we were having a meeting, and she paused the meeting and said, you know, Ed, can I share with you a little bit how I'm currently experiencing you? And I said, sure. Wow. And she, you know, gave me some critical feedback, but, you know, just that phraseology, that context, it was much better received than, you know, Ed, I'm really getting irritated, stop talking, or, you know, being a little bit more blunt. But she said, look, I'd like to share with you a little bit how I'm experiencing you. And we were able to talk about it much more effectively than not talking about it, or her going off and not saying anything. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a really effective way to build your knowledge on how others experience you.
What do you think made her feel comfortable that she could approach you and give you this direct feedback? Because most people notice something, but they keep it to themselves, right? They might not tell you directly.
Right. So this is a super important point, and this is growing in its awareness in organizations. And I see more and more articles on this. I see more and more LinkedIn articles, discussions about this, which is the importance of relationships. Mm-hmm. I can't expect you to do something unless you think it's okay to do it. So there right. are some bosses, it's like, oh, don't talk to Caesar today. He's having a bad day, right? You know, stay away from him, right? But I don't want to be that type of leader. I want someone to come to me at any time and say, hey, Ed, I need to talk with you about something. Do you have some time this afternoon or whatever? If people can't talk to me about how they're experiencing me or what they are experiencing, that's a problem. So yes. I need to ensure that in this relationship, I'm creating a place and a belief on the part of people who work with me or report to me that they can come speak to me at any time on any topic. In the moment, it may not be perfect. So we might schedule a time to talk about it, but it's better that they came to me than didn't. So, you know, a boss of mine once said, you know, Ed, if people can't come to me, they're going somewhere else. And I don't want them to go to somewhere else. You know, I want them to come to me to let me know about their experience or how they're experiencing me. So I think, Caesar, it's the creation of a relationship that I own creating mm-hmm. with everybody that I interact with to ensure that they are always comfortable giving me feedback. It's very hard to give feedback. It's just something, as you said earlier, we're not trained. We don't learn in school. You know, hey, I'm going to take a class, Feedback 101, on how to tell somebody something else that they may not want to hear. And yet we're thrown into leadership roles and are expected to do it. And yes. the best way to avoid doing something you don't know how to do is to avoid it. So we don't do it.
Yeah, no, it's giving feedback. It's an art and a science, I believe. what would be your recommendations to a manager, to a boss, on how to cultivate an environment, you know, within the organization, whether it's in the office or remote, on a culture of feedback? Like, what would you recommend?
Well, I've always loved that bumper sticker. I think it's an environmental bumper sticker that says, think big, act small, mm-hmm. right? So think big about saving the world, but act locally. So I think it starts with you. And I think it starts with ensuring that you believe that everybody mm-hmm. you work with, you have a good relationship with. Now that might include people who are not performing well and that you're having kind of tough conversations with. But as long as you're being candid and honest with them and supportive, your likelihood of having a good relationship is better than somebody who, you know, doesn't do that with you at all. So, you know, the first step, I think, is starting small and acting small, which mm-hmm. is ensuring that at least once or twice a year, it's not often, and it could be 15 to 20 minutes, you do what I call hosting a career development conversation. And a career development conversation is not about goals. It's not about objectives. It's not about, you know, clients or customers that we're working with. It's about you. How are you doing? Are you enjoying what you're doing? Is what you're doing helping you on your career, right? Tell me about you. That can help foster great relationships that create a back and forth mm-hmm. that will help all the things that we're talking about happen.
I love that. Scheduling career conversations. I'm going to start doing that myself. It's so important. Right, because it's easy to get too narrow focused into just your job, your area of responsibility, and not think about these kind of conversations that are so critical, so important. And I want to make a pause here and shift to your book. And I want to talk about that a little bit, because writing a book is it's a worthy endeavor, right? It's a big project. And I want to ask you about why now, right? Why you decided to write the book, and why focusing on spreading this message of driving your career, taking responsibility for your career?
Well, when I wrote Raise Your Visibility and Value, that really came from my 25 years in corporate organizations. And at the time I left in 2008, mm-hmm. many of us may recall that there was a recession that year. Yep. It was a horrible year to try to find a job. And that's also a reason why I decided to go out on my own. But you know, I realized that networking as an activity was really a subset of something bigger. Mm-hmm. And to me, the bigger message was raising your visibility. Mm-hmm. Of which an activity is networking, but there's many other activities that you can do in addition to networking to raise your visibility and value. Mm-hmm. After 13 years as a coach, I realized that there were recurring stories that would come up with clients, and I didn't bring them up purposefully, that they would just come up naturally. Mm-hmm. And I just happened to notice one day, hey, I'm telling that story again. I feel like I tell this story on a regular basis. I wonder if there's other stories, right, that just fit these people, and whether they were a company president or, you know, a line supervisor, these stories seem to always apply. Mm-hmm. And so I started to notice and ultimately came up with 9 stories, lessons for people, activities for folks to think about in respect to driving their career. And I just want to comment on something you said earlier. The world has very subtly moved from organizations taking care of you and ensuring that you grow to you needing to take care of yourself. And no one has said this. There's not been a big message put up saying you're on your own. But in reality, if you're not thinking about your own career and what you want to do and the direction you want to go in, nobody else is. And so it's important that you think about this and drive your career and think about, even if I'm starting a new job and I'm going to be in this job for 4 to 5 years, where is it taking me? What's going to be the next step? What are the options that I need to look at mm-hmm. in order to keep making progress? And so I thought it was a good time to share the 9 stories. They're all true stories from client work, but they repeated themselves on a frequent basis over the last 13 years.
That's amazing. And the message of the book could not be any more timely. Living in times of change, of disruption, even myself, I have experienced that shift of thinking that my work, my organization was going to take care of me, transitioning into, no, you're the driver, right? And you have to figure it out on your own. Where are you going? What's your developing that self-awareness around skill sets, around things you want to do, lifestyle? It's a big project to undertake. It's a big decision. How can we break this, I guess, educational model that doesn't really teach us about taking responsibility for our careers, right? Like it's all about, this is the assignment, this is the curriculum, this is the grades you're getting, and you end up working at this company or this industry, right? It's very linear in the way we're taught to manage our career. Do you have any recommendations throughout your years of experience working with different clients on how to break this mold that is, in a lot of ways, feels like shackles, right?
Right. Well, I would tell you that part of the answer is bigger than you and I, which is our educational model, right? So, you know, I ask people on a regular basis, you know, did you ever take a class where you learned about conflict navigation, where you learned about delegation, where you learned about how to provide often than not in junior high school and college, we do not focus on these behaviors. And yet we're then made a manager. And guess what? We have to suddenly be experts in how to navigate conflict and deal with challenging employees, overcome obstacles. And these are not things that we have learned and have been trained on. So I think over time, if in fact things continue to move in the direction they're moving, where we're more focused on relationships, where we're more focused on demonstrating empathy, where we're more focused on individual skill sets, the likelihood of this happening is greater. But you know, I don't foresee it happening, certainly in my lifetime. And I certainly do hope it happens at some point, because until we start sharing these observations and realities with people of what to experience in life early on, you know, we're just never going to make great progress. So you and I will be constantly employed, because that will be a void throughout their educational career. And then suddenly they need to know how to navigate conflict, and they have no idea how to start the sentence, how to identify the context for navigating the conflict, and hire somebody to come in and help them do that.
Yeah, it's a big challenge. And conflict resolution, it's something that I never, ever, it wasn't part of the curriculum, right? It wasn't part of the program. I think I took a few classes, but because I was curious about it. And this is a big theme on your book as well. The whole topic of curiosity, being curious about your career, right? Is that something that you develops naturally, or is it something that you have to cultivate?
So it does not develop naturally. And, you know, we tend to kind of follow models and expectations that people have of us in life. And this is not one of them that somebody says, hey, you know, take a little time and think about your career, right? I mean, it just doesn't happen that often. In most companies, there are companies that have career development offices. There are companies that have career development professionals. I'm not suggesting it doesn't happen anywhere. In fact, I know a few career development professionals who work at companies, public companies, but in most companies, it doesn't happen. And of course, when budgets get tight, like in 2008, et cetera, these are kind of the first things to go because they're viewed as kind of softer. So, you know, it is something that is required. And, you know, the subtext of Drive Your Career, of the title, are, you know, nine habits that you need to work on, right? These aren't things that others need to work on, but these are things you need to think about and focus on in order to ensure you're driving your career. Now, not everybody wants to be a driver. Some people are happy being passengers and happy to move along however life dictates they should move along. But, you know, I do believe that more of us want to be drivers who say, hey, at some point I want to be at this spot. You know, how do I get there? And I need to take certain steps in order to make sure it happens.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the biggest obstacles I've heard in navigating this career change, career path, is someone might have a goal of where they want to end up in their career, but they struggle with, if it's not a linear thing, right? If it's not linear, then they're not open to taking a few detours, right? They're not open to, maybe there are things that you might not enjoy doing, but they're part of that transition, right? That path. So how can we remain open to the possibilities, but still focus on that end goal, right? Once we have developed this roadmap of where we want to take our career.
Well, just as a quick example of kind of how broken the process is, and this is becoming increasingly less focused, but I know when I went to college, the first thing I had to do is pick a major. Well, no, I'm 17, 18. I have no idea what I want to be in life. And yet I was forced to pick a major. And I think the first major I picked was political science, because I thought that sounded really neat and interesting, whatever. I did graduate with a business degree, but you know, we have this expectation very early on in life of what you want to be when you grow up. And yet everybody's on a different journey. Everybody's time frame unfolds differently. And it's really up to you at whatever point in your life you're at. And I don't think there's a right spot or a wrong spot. So, for example, if by the time you're 40, you haven't figured out what you want to do, you're in trouble. I don't think so, right? Because there are many examples of very famous people who started doing what they're now known for in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, right? So,
yeah.
You know, I just think it happens when it happens. That said, there certainly are things you should be doing in order to ensure you're at least moving in a certain direction. But when that happens is up to you. So, you know, if a 65-year-old person wrote me and said, hey, I read Drive Your Career and it really helped me create a goal for myself in my remaining years, I'd be thrilled, right? Because that happens to be the time that it happened for them.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. There's no right or wrong time, only your own timeline, right? And we have social media to blame for that, because it's a comparison game daily on, you know, what someone else is doing versus your own path. And it's a hard thing to do, not to compare yourself to others on social media. But the answers lie within yourself, right? Awesome. And I want to shift here into another theme of the book, which is overall communication, right? Whether it's with your boss, having a good relationship with your boss or your teammates. And I wanted to dive deeper and get your thoughts on one of the hardest challenges about communication is, in my opinion, aligning the communication styles, right? Between your own style and your boss's style and your teammate's style. And I wanted to ask you, what recommendations can you give us on how to best approach that? And if the communication styles clash, how do you solve those type of conflicts in a productive way?
Well, I'll give you a response that I think can work for most people. Of course, there's no answer that's going to work for everyone. Mm-hmm. And somebody's communication style may be so different than their boss's that the likelihood of any alignment is impossible. But there's a conversation that could happen in corporations around the world that is not happening right now, which is you find some time to spend with your boss and you say, hey, Caesar, you know, I just wanted to talk with you for about 20 minutes. Can we do that on Friday at lunch, whatever, you know, so forth and so on. And say, look, you know, I'd like to learn a little bit more about your style, you know, how you operate and how you approach the work that you do, not what you're doing, right? I don't want to talk about specifically the work that we're doing, but how you approach it and how you operate. This is a great conversation to have if you're new. So if you're new in a role reporting to somebody, or if you have a new boss, so your role is not changed, but your boss is new, say, hey, let's find a little bit of time just to talk about style. You know, how you operate and how you work, because that can be very effective. I'm not suggesting that will answer everybody's situation, but it can create a conversation, which again leads to relationships that can help influence people a little bit more effectively. At my last company, I worked for somebody and she had a very specific leadership style and a very specific communication style, and it fit with mine perfectly, right? I could even finish her sentences. She decided to move on to another opportunity after about 6 years, and a new boss came in and we were significantly different. And we never had this conversation about style, you know, methodology, et cetera. And so we never fixed it. It never got resolved. And there were always these kind of differences and there were questions and there was why, you know, the question always started with why did you do that? Or why did this happen? You know, that type of thing. So I think talking about it a little bit and ensuring people understand how you operate and how you approach things and how they operate and how they approach things can help start, you know, building that bridge.
Yeah, absolutely. So start that conversation and make time to have conversations around communication style and what works and what doesn't. So hopefully find that middle ground. And I see it almost as, well, it is being proactive and managing up, which is a very new concept for a lot of people, including myself. It's something that I've had to learn through trial and error, because I have been conditioned to think that the answers and the initiatives should come from my boss, should come from my manager. And through a lot of mistakes and trial and error, I've learned that no, actually, you can be that driver. You can be the one managing up, making suggestions for communication or projects, or even to share challenges, right, that might be coming up in your particular role. What do you have any advice on that? And in terms of how to effectively manage up if you have a boss that doesn't give you any direction, doesn't really tell you if you're doing great or not. I'll be interested to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, a couple of things come to mind. One, and we've talked about this a little bit, and this is another reason why it's important, is to have conversations with your boss where you're transparent, talking about style. And sometimes we miss the obvious, right? So you might want more direction. Your boss is thinking you're getting enough direction, so you never talk about it. And at some point you have to say, hey, Caesar, you know, I really love working with you. I love this role that I have. I'd like to talk a little bit about a couple of things we might do differently in order to help me be more effective. Are you open to that? And I would hope most bosses, they may not, but most bosses would say, absolutely, let's talk about it. You know, there are going to be some difficult relationships, right? There are people today who should not be bosses, and they are, and they're very self-oriented. Mm-hmm. They're very biased about themselves. And it's very hard to work with those people.
Yeah.
Oftentimes your only answer is to find someone else to work for, because you'll never make any great progress there. But I do believe as long as you are respectful and professional, your likelihood for progress is greater. If you're not respectful, so you're emotional, or you're talking at the water cooler about it, but not to the person who can fix it, mm-hmm. or you're not professional in how you handle it, your likelihood for success is diminished significantly. So I believe as long as you're respectful, as long as you're professional, that you schedule some time with your boss to talk about these items, that you take a deep breath and say, hey, there's a couple of things I want to talk about with you today. I've never talked with anybody about these before, but you know, I hope we can have a great conversation about it. If you can get those things out, your likelihood for making progress is greater. I know these are not easy. So I know it's not easy to talk to a boss, especially if you have a difficult relationship, but your likelihood of making positive progress is greater if you do something about it. You won't make any progress if you don't do anything.
Absolutely agree with that, Ed. It's not easy, even for myself, right? Throughout my career, it's been always in the back of my mind of, man, what if I say something and I get fired, right? That's the first thought that comes into my mind. But the alternative is continue doing things in a dysfunctional way, right? And not really moving your career forward because you're afraid of having those conversations. So it definitely takes courage.
It does. And, you know, I joke with people that, you know, if I respectfully and professionally provide my boss some feedback, which I ask if they would want, you always also want to ask for permission to say, hey, I have some observations of the meeting this morning about how you led the meeting. Are you open to some feedback? And if they say yes, then the door is open, right? But, you know, if I provide constructive, positive, and respectful feedback and I get fired, you don't belong there anyway. Right?
That is so true.
And I'm not trying to be trivialize it, but you know, if you get fired for something like that and you're respectful and professional, you know, it was a bad place to start with. And they're probably doing you a favor by kicking you out the door.
I agree with you. And in this market, it's a candidate market, right? So you most likely find something, a better place.
Absolutely.
Organization. Now, Ed, how has writing two books now, how has that process changed you and for drive your career out of the nine stories or the nine tactics that you mentioned in the book, which one was like the one that was non-obvious to you that made you think, oh, I had not considered that before?
Well, to answer your first question, writing the books, you know, the word that I think of as you ask that question is solidify, right? That by getting it out of my head and onto paper that I can now read on a repeated basis or know that others are reading really helps solidify my experiences in the workplace. This is all experiential work. These aren't thoughts that I had in the shower that don't apply to anybody, but these are actual experiences. And I just know as people read the book, their head's going to be shaking saying, yep, I've experienced that. Yes, I've done that, right? And you know, what can I do about it? You know, to be honest, I don't think any of them were surprising because they came up organically. And as I mentioned, you know, I started to share, hey, here's something you should think about, or have you thought about this before? And then 2 weeks later, hey, here's something to think about. And it's the same story. And it's like fitting different people. You know, the one that I think has the largest area of opportunity for folks is the last chapter, which is it's all about empathy. Because I think empathy is viewed corporately as somewhat of a soft skill. And from my perspective, it is a very strong strategic strategy, which is really working with people to influence them and have a positive relationship with them. Because the more positive relationship you have, the more likely you'll be able to lead them, right? People want to work for people they like. And it's hard to work with somebody or for somebody who appears to be too clinical. And you need to show empathy in order to build strong relationships.
I love it. And yeah, and that's another one of your themes for the book is, or the three soft skills that I picked up throughout your book was empathy, listening, and being curious, right? Which we talked about. And I think these soft skills, even though there's nothing soft about them, because I would say they're harder to develop than any hard skills out there, like coding or learning how to do Excel formulas, because it has to do with our relationship with and how we communicate, right? How we interpret the world. But I think they're going to be the unfair advantage of not just as an individual, but any organization out there that put this as part of their culture, right? Like having empathy, for not just their teammates, but their customers, listening and being curious, which they sound very simple, but I know in practice, it's harder to practice. And I know we're coming near to wrap up the episode, but I just wanted to ask you one more question around soft skills. And in terms of recommendations that you may have to someone that wants to be a better listener, have more curiosity, have more empathy, what would you recommend to someone, whether it's at the C-suite or someone just starting their career?
Well, I just want to pause for a second, Caesar, because I want to point out at a training program I did last week, the three leadership skills that I shared with people that I believe all leaders need to do more effectively in order to be a better leader are curiosity, listening, and empathy. So you picked up on that, which is brilliant. those are the three skills. And these are not soft skills. These are hard skills. We need to relabel these because we are doing a disservice to the challenges that leaders face by calling these things soft skills. I know why we call them soft skills, but what it's created over time is people thinking that they're easier or nicer, and it's not. These are very hard and difficult things to do, and we're not training people on how to do them, right? So we have a double-edged sword that we're working against, that they're hard to do, and we don't tell you how to do them. So, you know, I just think people being, I think the first step anybody should do in order to enjoy this journey is to do a 360 of some sort. And whether you interview people or you hire someone to interview them or you do an online 360, you need a baseline to know where you are. There are leaders out there who are great listeners. There are leaders out there who are always very curious and they always show empathy, right? It's not as if it's an absence of that, but almost all of us can get a little bit better at curiosity and asking great questions and learning more about the other person before you share your perspective. Listening, if you're going to ask a question, you have to be a great listener, and showing empathy where appropriate. You don't show empathy all of the time, but there are moments where you need to be empathetic and put yourself at the place where the other person is so they know that their situation is important to you at that moment. So, collect some feedback so you have a place to start.
I love it. And this conversation has given me a lot to think about in terms of my career and how I can do things differently. Going back to your one of the most important questions out of this conversation, right? And I hope that it does the same for our audience on just reflecting on your career, where you want to go, where you want to take it, and how you can do things differently in your work, in your relationships, right? Because that's the most important thing that we can do, right? Have some self-awareness and reflection on where we're going.
Yes.
Now, and I always like to ask my guests, because I'm a big reader myself, and I wanted to ask you on your most recommended book or the book that you have gifted the most to friends, colleagues, and that has had an impact in your life, in your work.
Well, my current most favorite book, you know, it does shift from time to time as I read more books. I am a big book reader. My current favorite is The Fearless Organization by Amy Edmondson. Mm-hmm. And this talks a little bit about the idea of psychological safety. And psychological safety is something a leader needs to create culturally in their team or their organization that allows people to say what they want to say without fear of judgment or belittlement. And unfortunately, this doesn't exist a lot in organizations or teams. And people don't speak up because they feel they're going to be judged or they're going to be belittled. And so they don't say what they need to say, which could be helpful to teams. So I love the topic and would encourage all of our listeners to look at the book, The Fearless Organization by Amy Edmondson, to understand the concept of psychological safety and start doing something about it.
I love it. We'll make sure to put that in the show notes as well. And psychological safety, we could have another podcast just around that topic, but it's extremely important to create that kind of environment. Awesome, man. Well, where can people follow you, find your book, you know, best ways to do that? If someone wants to reach out to you, maybe with questions around a conversation, what would be the best way to do that?
Folks should go to my website, www.excellius.com. And that's E-X-C-E-L-L. ius.com. There's everything there that you need to know and ways to contact me as well.
Thank you so much, Ed. So we'll make sure to put that in the show notes as well. But for now, thank you so much for the conversation, for writing this book, putting it out there into the world, and spreading such an important message on taking responsibility for your career. And it was a pleasure having you on the show, and looking forward to more episodes as well.
I loved our conversation today, Caesar. Thanks for having me as a guest.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.